This morning we had a reading from a Dhamma talk of Lumpo Cha's in the, one of the talks in the book Food for the Heart, and talk entitled Transcendence. And one of the passages in there that particularly caught my attention was when Lumpo said something like, when a person receives a new posting or some kind of promotion, then this is all just anatta. Don't think of this in any other terms. These things are all empty of value and any real meaning. So, as probably most people gathered here are aware, the invitation was made to me in Thailand by Lumpo Sumedho to take up a new posting in England, to take on the role of the abbot at Amravati. And so that's been that was in the air for a few weeks. We waited until Ajahn Pasno and I had a chance to come back and to discuss things with the community here. That discussion happened a week ago, Saturday of last week, on the full moon. And so it was discussed, and the community here agreed to that, to give their sadhu to that invitation. And so I accepted that and then let Lumpo know. He was still in Thailand at the time. He's very, very keen to retire from his role as the abbot and leader of community at Amravati and to be a free agent. And so I am very happy to support him in that. Obviously, there's a lot of sadness in the idea of leaving Abhayagiri and the noble companionship of the community here, the monastic community, lay community, and the wonderful place that has grown up in the last 15 years, 20 years, if you count the era of preparation and the thought, the idea, the vision of creating a forest monastery here was still in potentia. So mixtures of feelings involved with that, but it was striking just listening to Lumpo's words in that respect, of how when such a move is made, different perceptions, different feelings get triggered. It's been striking how when many members of the lay community who've heard about this or let people know, and they come back with words, congratulations! And most of the monastic community come back with the words like, oh dear, you really sure you want to do this? Oh, God, poor guy. Okay. Well, good luck. It's quite a distinct variation of responses. One of our friends said, are they going to give you a raise? I said, well, 0 + 0 = 0. So I guess I get a 100% raise. But it's interesting to contemplate that that the situation and this prospect and its different attendant feelings, and particularly that teaching of Lumpo's, where he's talking about the importance of looking at the roles that we occupy as a human being in terms of these being not self. These are empty formations. These have no value or validity, no intrinsic substance other than what we impute to them. we suppose them into existence, we give them value, and then if we don't see that, then we get caught up in that. So we think that we really are an abbot, or we think we really are a doctor, or we really think we are retired, or that we think that we are a monastic, or a layperson, or a woman, or a man. That these formations, these sankharas, are imbued with that extra coloration, validity, solidity. Qualities that they don't truly possess in an absolute way. But it's not easy for us, is it, to look at our roles and the conditioning of our lives in such an objective fashion. It's hard to get a handle on that. I was also reminded how before I came to settle in the States, we made a visit. Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Sundra, Ajahn Jodhika, Sister Jodhika, and myself made a visit in 1990. That was the first time I came to the States, and it was with the idea of coming over and planting the seeds to respond to the invitation of the Sangapala Foundation, the group to start up a monastery here. And so I came in 1990, and then after Lumpur and the other sisters left, and I stayed for a few weeks, and that seemed to go pretty well. And I came back again in 1991 and stayed for 4 months, and that seemed to go very well. And so there was a lot of enthusiasm to actually have me move over here and to establish a new branch monastery. So that was in the during the year of 1991, and there was a fair amount of momentum for it to happen that a new branch monastery was going to open up in the Bay Area in the spring of 92. And so during that year, I remember I was writing this. It was suggested that I write some sort of little brochure, and we have some sort of booklet to distribute to people to go with the opening of the new monastery. And also the idea was that Ajahn Sujito's book on the Dhammacakka Sutta, his commentary on the illuminated manuscript called The Dawn of the Dhamma, that was going to be printed at the same time. And it was sort of open the monastery and then have Ajahn Sujito's new book and set the wheel rolling in the USA. Of course, things didn't work out like that. But the Ajahn Sujito, in the late 90s, we were joking that the monastery, mid-90s, that we were joking that both the monastery and the book were neck and neck in the starting blocks, both completely stationary. But the monastery wasn't happening and the book wasn't being printed either. But while I was doing this little brochure, it was an interesting unfolding, because I started writing this essay to talk about forest monastery life and the background of our community and the basis of the teachings and practice and so forth, as to be the idea of a handout to people. And then after a couple of weeks of drafting this and putting words down on paper, I remember I just had sort of read through the whole thing and had a sort of appraisal of what I'd written so far. And it was just before the evening sitting at Amaravati, and so I went into the evening puja and the chanting, and then during the period of the sitting, then a lot of the words, the sentences that I'd been writing came back to me, and it was this kind of sickening feeling, this sort of sinking, nauseating feeling of, like, you know, that there was this, even though on one level I was talking about forest monasticism, you know, the Venerable Ajahn Chah and the Four Noble Truths, that there was this thread running through it, or really sort of encompassing the whole thing, which was it was all about me. It's me that's moving over to the USA. It's me that's opening the monastery. It's me that's doing everything. and how it was sort of my life as a monk was taking shape blossoming coming to some sort of fulfillment with this move. Even though it hadn't been my intention, of course, ignorance works very effectively this way, that all these phrases started popping into my mind of what I'd been writing and what had sort of snuck in there, and how that it was all about it just taking the shape of this huge becoming project. And this kind of ghastly nausea came over me. I thought, that's revolting. what the hell am I talking about? What is this? Where's this coming from? And so then after the evening meditation had finished, I went back and looked at it again and thought, this is really totally off the mark. This is absolutely not what it's about at all. And I remember the many hearing and had heard many, many times over Lumpo Sumedho talking about his invitation to go to England from the group in London, the English Sangha Trust, back in the 70s, and how over and over again he said that whenever he thought in terms of, I've got to go to England, I've got to take the forest tradition from Thailand and transplant it in England, I've got to take the Dhamma to the West, he immediately feel incredibly tense and intimidated and depressed and incompetent. But as soon as he thought, I'm being invited to go and practice the Dhamma in England and live as a bhikkhu, then immediately he felt spacious and bright and at ease. And so that's what popped into my mind. And it was a powerful source of reflection, that rather than some sort of coming here to the States and the idea of opening up a monastery as some sort of coming of age or a fruition or some sort of achievement or anything of that nature, that it was far more to do with that what actually a monastery is. It's not a place of becoming, it's a place of relinquishment. It's a place of non-becoming, a place of non-possession. That's what makes a monastery a monastery, and that's what makes it a place of liberation. It's not a place to become a monastic or to become enlightened or to become the devout, committed layperson. It's not even though those habits can trickle in, we can occupy our role even as in, you know, I am the stores monk, or I am the abbot, or I am the kitchen manager, or I'm the one in charge of the wood pile. Yeah, we're such territorial creatures. It doesn't take much. Like the Sutta Ajahn Pasana is very fond of quoting about the dung beetle. You know, I am a dung beetle. This is my dung ball. I've got the biggest ball of dung that any dung beetle has. You know. I'm the champion dung beetle. Ha. You look at me and quiver, you inferior dung beetles. Yeah, it doesn't take much. As one of the suttas that is most instructive in terms of pride and achievement. Look at my pile of dung. You know, I got the biggest ball of dung in the whole damn forest. Yeah. So, but it's easy to forget that. And so, as it was, then after that insightful evening, I completely rewrote that entire brochure, and it became entitled "Vanishing Point," as an indication of the sort of change of perspective that it was about letting go and relinquishment. And it was such an effective vanishing point that actually the idea to open the monastery in 1992 vanished also, with the a whole slew of senior monks and nuns disrobing and a kind of crisis of faith in the community back in 91, 92. So that we put the opening of the new monastery on hold. But it was a powerful insight and a very helpful thing at that time. And it was really talking about the same shift of view, the same shift of perspective that Lumpo Cha was talking about in the Dhamma talk that was read today. That when we are given a particular role or position, we take become an anagarika or become a novice or become a bhikkhu, become a upasika, we kind of live in the and we move into the role of being an executive or being a parent or being any kind of social role, but it translates through all sorts of different areas of our life, that it's easy, particularly in the eyes of the world, if the world praises that, oh, you know, you got an award, you won the Oscar, you got made the CEO, or you got the tokens of approval bestowed upon you. You know, congratulations. So those are our natural habits and judgments that we're conditioned to be impressed by. My sister got an OBE at New Year, and the New Year's honors list. She's Kate Horner OBE now. she's very happy about that. But yeah, amongst other circles, it means nothing. Most people in the States go, OBE? What's an OBE? It means Officer of the British Empire. So just for your information, FYI. FYI, OBE is Officer of the British Empire. So we are conditioned to value those kind of things, and they have their place in the human world in a relative sense. But as soon as we take them to be solid realities, or we think they mean something, especially if it's involved in the spiritual domain, then they can become real hindrances to us. If we think that we're trying to become an Ajahn or become a teacher, or you know, become a lay minister or something, that convention then becomes a hindrance. It obstructs the very thing that it's designed to facilitate. This is one of those brutal ironies of the spiritual realm. Similarly with other aspects of practice, the meditation techniques or even the rules and protocols that we follow. So it's always good to bear it in mind that this is the essential spirit of the going forth and the monastic training, the training of commitment to the Triple Gem and the five precepts, or the eight and the ten precepts, precepts that go with a full ordination, that these are not an accumulation, but they're a means to support letting go. It was also striking when we were when Ajahn Pasano were in and I were in Thailand, and it was during one of the sessions of the abbots, the meetings of the abbots of the Western monasteries. During one of those days, Lumpur Sumedho had leaned over towards me and said, could I see you in my kuti later this evening? And I said, sure. So I had gone over that evening, and I thought he wanted to discuss where our next Dharma jaunt was going to be. Well, we'd done Bhutan and Egypt and Japan, the Arctic. So where next? You know, Patagonia, China, Galapagos Islands. You know. So seriously, that's what I thought he was wanted to talk about. And so, but instead. I got to his kuti, and actually he was in the middle of getting a massage from somebody, and so he the first thing he said was, "I want to ask you if I could invite you to take over as abbot at Amaravati." So that was how the conversation began. Anyway, the next morning I was Ajahn Pasno and Ajahn Jayasara, Ajahn Sujito, and I were all staying in the same building, so I snagged Ajahn Pasno early the next morning and said, "Can I mention something before we before we begin the day?" And so that so I passed on the news about this invitation, and once Ajahn Pasno put his jaw back in place, and we both agreed that it was like swallowing a whale. The plan for the morning was that all of us were, after the closing session of the meeting, we were going to go over to the main monastery, Wat Pa Pong, and pay our respects to Lumpo Liam, the abbot of Wat Pa Pong, who Lumpo Cha had appointed as his sort of successor. He was his second monk for many years, and asked him to take care of Wat Pa Pong after he'd become incapacitated. And has been the abbot of Wat Pa Pong ever since then, since that time, since he's been looking after it ever since Lumpo Cha got ill in 1981. And anyway, I went over there, and then after paying respects to Lumpo Liam, to visit the Chedi, the stupa, and all pay our respects together. To the Lumpo Cha's relics, and to close our meeting in that way. Most of you who have met Lumpo Liam, who was here in the spring of last year, or met him in Thailand, who went on the Karmistas, our group went to Thailand 4 years ago, and visited the monasteries there, met Lumpo Liam at that time. Well, no, he's a very sort of understated kind of a person, not very demonstrative, and it's extremely rare in any kind of gathering, as I understand, that he will address people in person very much. His comments are usually sort of directed off at into the corners of the room, so there was about 25 or 30 of us who come over from the Western Monastery to Wat Pa Pong to pay our respects. And along with one other of the monks gathered, Ajahn Khemanando, then to my surprise, Lumpo Liam addressed me by name and in amongst the group, and which was kind of startling. And amongst other things, he didn't know anything about the conversation. Yeah, ha ha ha. Seemingly, he should not have known anything about the conversation that had occurred with Lumpo Sameda the previous evening. But one of the things that he said was, when you take on responsibilities, you shouldn't see it. There's no need to see it as a burden. You know, the work of helping other people doesn't have to be seen as anything burdensome or difficult. It's not helpful to see it in that way. It's not necessary to see it in that way. And then, if you think in terms of what you might get in return, what we get in return is emptiness. That's what we can expect to receive as a reward. Of the work that we do is emptiness. And so it's extraordinarily apropos. when another of the comments that was made when we were in Thailand that both Ajahn Pasano and I were quite struck by was Ajahn Biak said of Lumpur Liem, nobody ever overestimates Lumpur Liem. You know, everybody underestimates him. Mm-hmm. That you know, he's way ahead of the curve most of the time, and most people don't realize it. So it was an extraordinarily sort of helpful and clear reflection of that same principle that, you know, you might think, well, I do all this work. I'm working so hard. I'm doing all this. I'm clearing all these trails. I'm working in the kitchen. I'm slugging away, following my breath all day and night. You know, somebody should recognize this. I should get some kind of a recognition or, you know, maybe not an OBE, but something. Some kind of point. Do we get points here? You know, Dharma credits or little gold stars or gold Dharma chakras. Is there some kind of ranking system or merit points? And so that was a really, really helpful way of pointing to that when we work or put effort into, say, helping others or into some kind of wholesome activity, then what we get in return, the reward that we should expect, is emptiness. And that might seem on the one hand, like to from a worldly perspective, like, oh, I mean, can't we, you know, wouldn't it be nice to get to some sort of something? But also it's a double-edged quality insofar as that the being, because taking on a role of helping others or leadership, like the co-abbotship here, Ajahn Pasano and I, or while we were away, Ajahn Yatiko and Ajahn Sudanto, Ajahn Kurundamo, very capably and nobly looking after things, that along with the what you might get sort of appreciation or praise or expressions of gratitude, you also become a projection sink for people's criticisms. That you know, one of Lumpur Cha's definitions of the abbot of the monastery is the garbage pit. That your job is to be the recipient of all of the garbage that people dump on you, and that the negative projections, that's part of the job. A description is to be the negativity sink. So, but also the negativity, criticism, complaining, criticizing, this isn't right and that's not right and I don't like this and he's all wrong and she shouldn't be like that and shouldn't be done this way, that's all empty too. What we receive, it's not just the positive things that that are empty, but the negative things. Yeah, all of it is empty, and that emptiness is not actually any kind of a real sense of. It shouldn't convey. If we reflect, we'll see it doesn't actually convey a sense of lack or something absent, something missing, but it's a spaciousness. It's a freedom. It's a heart devoid of the obstructions of I making and my making, because that's what is the fundamental inhibitor of the heart's freedom is. What the Buddha called ahankara mamankara, the I-making and mind-making, the underlying tendencies to conceit. This again, like as Lumpur Cha was saying in that talk this morning, this is the basic problem, is that of atta, of the mind taking things and turning them into a self, and that which belongs to a self. I-making, ahankara, mind-making, mamankara. And the underlying tendencies to conceit, the man anusaya, mana is conceit, anusaya is the underlying tendency. So that when we see that you know, what we get in return for all our efforts of trying to do all the dishes, yeah, clear all the paths, stay awake for 21 hours a day, mindful of every moment. that the fact that, that what we get in return is emptiness is wonderful. I mean, it's a reality anyway. It's also, there's a wonderful quality to it, because the Dhamma is the place of, the realization of Dhamma is the place of non-possession. It's a place of no-thingness. It's the it's the refuge is one of non-ownership. There isn't a person there to own or to be or to have or to lose. This is the wonderful blessing that the Dhamma teachings point us to and remind us of the possibility of realizing. So along with social structures, you know, like roles, like being in charge of the monastery or in charge of posting out the mail or in charge of the kitchen or in charge of the cleaning the toilets or whatever it might be. It's also the same principle pertains to the practices that we follow, the kind of meditation techniques that we take up. Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, or walking meditation, metta practice. It also applies to the rules that we keep, the five precepts, the eight precepts, the 227 precepts, the protocols of the monastery. In exactly the same way, when the mind adheres to the form and gives that an intrinsic value, that this is what the Buddha called silapata paramasa, or attachment to rules or rituals and conventions, observances, that we think that just by following this practice, by carrying out this particular procedure with the meditation, you know, that carrying out this particular activity, reciting these words, the idea or the belief that that has an intrinsic worth or is intrinsically liberating, yeah, that's what the Buddha's point is. If that's believed in, then that becomes an obstruction. That's a fetter. That's what hinders us. And that in order to make those practices, the rules that we keep and the meditation practices that we follow and the things that define our style of living, it's a mysterious chemistry whereby these work. It's ironic in many ways, because it's only by not seeing them as absolutely real and absolutely solid and as of absolute value that they can actually function properly. They work best if we don't take them to be absolutely real and solid. If we remember that these are empty formations, then the practices that we use can liberate the heart more easily. The Vinaya that we follow can support insight and liberation more effectively. The more that the mind clings to those inner attributes, those inner attitudes and activities, and says, it's by doing this work, by keeping this rule, by following this schedule, by reciting these verses, that this is the crucial thing, then we're taking refuge in a behavior, aren't we? We're taking refuge in a formation of sounds and feelings, sensations, thoughts. And those in themselves, they can't liberate. They can be skillful means if they're applied and used in a wise way. But the simple tracking of the breath, or the simple the intention to, you know, cultivate loving kindness, that in itself cannot liberate. The keeping of a precept in itself, in and of itself, the restraining of a speech or a kindly generous act in and of itself, those can't liberate. They are skillful and supportive, wholesome qualities that can create the conditions for a brightness of mind and a freedom from remorse. But the actions themselves, just like the social roles that we play, they can't have an intrinsic absolute value. It's impossible. This is not the way reality is. Nature isn't that way. So when we remember that, and we hold the precepts that we follow and the practices that we cultivate, we hold them in that light, in that context, then mysteriously we find that we're able to use them more effectively. We don't take it as an identity. And then the quality of ownership, again, the looking even more deeply at it, not just the pattern of activity of following the particular meditation technique of or the activity, the work within the mind, but also just even in deeper, the sense of me doing it, me experiencing it, me being the recipient of the results. This is me, the meditator, me who's experiencing peacefulness, or me who's experiencing a busy mind, or me who's doing walking meditation, me who's sitting listening to a Dhamma talk. Insofar as there's that is me and mine, as long as there's a ahankara, mamankara, I making and my making, that's unexamined, unchallenged, then to that same degree will the heart be fettered, will be hindered. And so as Ajahn Chah said in the Dhamma talk this morning, if I remember correctly, it's about holding and letting go. Holding and letting go. We pick things up, we know them, we let them go. It's all just things coming into being. They change during their cycle of life, and then they dissolve. If we cling to them or identify with them, then we create suffering right there. If we don't cling to them, if there's no clinging, there's no identification with them, then no suffering is created. And this is the worth, the fundamental value of all of the different structures of our life, whether it's our body, whether it's our social role as a layperson, as a monastic, as a woman, as a man, as an anagarika, or as a co-abbot, as someone who's new, someone who's old, whatever the roles might be, whether it's as an aspect of the meditation or the jobs that we do, just seeing where those habits of identification take root. Me who's listening to this talk, me who's raking a path, me who's being a success, me who's being a failure, me who's got it together, me who's falling apart, me who's absolutely in doubt about absolutely everything. Seeing that I-making and my-making quality, that becoming urge, taking hold of even the most innocent of activities, the most, as well as all the way through the spectrum to the most heavily loaded things with our names up in lights. Yeah, basically, it's all the same. It's all the same. And to get to know that becoming habit, whatever the emotional tone around it may be, if it's gratification or fear or irritation or confusion, that's all by the by. Just getting to know that feeling of becoming that habit and seeing there's a choice that can be let go of, that can be relinquished. And when it's relinquished, when that becoming ceases, then this is truly the vanishing point, the I feeling vanishes, the mine feeling vanishes. There's a It's that the place of relinquishment, the place of non-possession. This is Nibbana. The cessation of becoming is Nibbana. Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. And then the things that we live with, this body, this monastery, this community, these structures that we live with, then they all become things that serve that quality of awakening. They support that insight. They support that the effort that we've come here to fulfill. They do everything that is possible to enable that intention. Our intention in coming to this place, gathering at this time, for those intentions to be fulfilled. So I offer these thoughts for reflection this evening. Sarukaram